Okay, I think we're on the air. Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming to the Rehab Services Committee meeting. And we have a program for you this afternoon. We're going to have Joe Xavier give us an update about services and VR Mod. And we have Kate Williams and Debbie Bacon that are going to talk to you about employment services and the new team approach. So to get started, I would like to have introductions so that everybody knows who's here. I'm Nellie Emerson, and I will have you go to the right and introduce yourselves.
Good afternoon, everybody. Joe Xavier, Department of Rehabilitation.
Hi, my name is Alice McGrath, and I'm on the Rehab Committee, and I work at Vista Center for the Blind in Palo Alto.
Mitch Pomerantz, President of the American Council of the Blind, and this weekend I'm the delegate for the San Gabriel Valley chapter of CCB.
This is Debbie Bacon. I work for the Employment Services Department at the Lighthouse for the Blind, and my focus is on work adjustment training.
And this is Kate Williams. I'm with the Employment Services for the Lighthouse of Blind in San Francisco, and my function is with the Employment Immersion Program for job-ready people. Ready.
Moving back to the rebels here, sitting in the back.
Good afternoon. My name is David Jackson. I am a board of directors for the California Council of the Blind and also a member of the San Francisco chapter.
Hi, everyone. My name is Teresa Bowie, and I work with Junior Blind of America for the STEP program up here in Northern California.
Good afternoon. Richard Retha, Director of Transition Services for the Junior Blind of America.
Hi, guys. This is Benna Kim, Department of Rehab.
Hi, this is Therese Gardner, Department of Rehabilitation, Modesto Branch, and a Rehab Committee member at large.
Can people hear through this?
Well, okay, this one's actually working. Great, all right. Well, I would like to go ahead and introduce Joe Xavier and have him talk to us about all the wonderful new information and updates for Department of Rehab.
Thank you, Nellie. Is this coming through okay? Okay. Well, so first of all, thank you for inviting me to come here and present. It's always nice to come back to CCB and to visit with everybody and have an opportunity to visit with the members and, with staff that are here. So thank you for that invitation. Ed had called me a number of months ago. Actually, Ed had invited me to come down and present to the fall conference, and I was scheduled to do so. Unfortunately, I had a death in a family and a funeral that was the same day as the convention was taking place, so obviously I wasn't able to attend that. So shortly after that convention, he said, okay, how about spring? I said, deal. So a few months ago, he called me and he reminded me of my commitment, and I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago, and of course he's not able to be here. So Nellie, thank you for taking over for him. I'm sure he appreciates it. And, he asked me to report back on how well you did. So I'll let him know. So Ed had asked me to speak to you about three topics, and I'll do so. And then of course, I'm always willing to take any questions that you have. Mitch Pomerantz The president of ACB is here, and he and I have an agreement that I'll take the easy questions and he'll take all the difficult ones. So that's even better. So you can join me there, and we'll have that discussion also. So the three things that Ed had asked me to present on were the Orientation Center for the Blind, BEP, and then talk more specifically about the vocational rehabilitation modernization, our service delivery model. So I'll present on those, and I'll leave it to Nelly and Tricia how they wish to handle questions, either in between each one or at the end. It's up to you guys. So let me start with OCB. First of all, if you don't know, we have an acting administrator at OCB, and Henry Lang, who is a former district administrator, is the acting administrator. Warren Hayes had been there for a number of years in an acting capacity, but more specifically the last year of, in 2011, he really bailed us out by stepping in to provide leadership to the campus, particularly because there was a significant renovation going on that I'll talk about here. Last September, well, first of all, let me digress and say that we had conducted a recruitment for the administrator position last spring, summer, and that unfortunately did not result in us hiring an administrator. But in September, we did hire a rehabilitation supervisor. And for those of you who don't know, Rosa Gomez has taken that position, and Rosa was formerly one of Tricia's counselors in the Oakland area. And she has, of course, typical Rosa, for those of you that know her, hit the ground running, ideas come faster than I can listen to them, and stepping right in, learning all of the nuances of being in a residential setting and doing a great job. When the Congress approved the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act funds, and of course California got, well, in total about $62 million, it was a tremendous opportunity to upgrade a residential center that had been built back in the 50s and by and large had not had significant work done to it. And it really has turned out to be a very, very worthwhile investment. We will be having an open house on May 8th. So for those of you who are in the area and you have an opportunity to stop by, I encourage you to do so. You won't recognize the place. The structures are the same, but we've redone floors, walls, fixtures, made restrooms usable and accessible. Pathways have been taken care of, set up a conference center, installed an elevator in the dorm so people can get to the second floor who are not able to use stairs, put in a computer lab that will allow students to not just go through classes but have access to doing their computer training before and after hours. We have put in single occupancy rooms that will function as almost like an apartment living setting where the students will get to put to practice the skills that they have been learning the last few weeks that they're there, which prepares them for a better transition back into community living. The other thing that this has allowed us to do, of course, is to take a look at the curriculum that's been in place. And one of the tasks that Warren and staff had in 2011 was to at least put on paper what was taking place at OCB and start to look at what it was that we could be doing with the campus, because our objective is to maximize that campus in every which way, which not only includes capacity in terms of occupancy, but capacity in terms of programming. So we published that document last August. We invited the community to provide feedback on that. They did. We incorporated the appropriate feedback, and we have shared that out. And now we're going to be entering. We have actually began, but we're going to be doing strategic planning for that curriculum. And let me step back and say that, talk about strategic planning real briefly. The department as a whole is undergoing strategic planning. And essentially, strategic planning, I know it's an art that's very hard to get your head around, even when you're involved in it, let alone when you just hear the terminology. But think of strategic planning in a very simple way. The first thing that we, of course, establish is the vision. And the vision clearly describes where we want to be as a community in 10, 15, 20 years. And then we simply ask ourselves three questions. And those three questions are, what is it that we're not doing that we need to start doing to get to that vision? What is it that we're doing that does not contribute to getting to that vision that we need to stop? And then number three is, what is it that we are doing that we need to do much better in order to achieve that vision? All that information then gets distilled into an operationalized program on a year-by-year basis to move us toward where that vision. The first step of that was engaging with the staff at OCB. We've done that. We're going to be engaging the consumers, the students who are there now. I believe this coming week, we'll be engaging the Blind Advisory Committee on May the 24th. We're going to be engaging with Blind Field Services staff and then other interested community partners between now and the end of May. And that is a process that we're also undertaking for Blind Field Services, the Business Enterprises Program, and the Older Individuals Who Are Blind Program. So let me conclude my remarks there. Well, let me just briefly, I mentioned some of the things that we've done with the renovation. And frankly, for me to do that justice, it would take a lengthy discussion. But if you are here over the next couple of days, I will be here. I'd be glad to answer any questions individually about that. And if you guys want to, you want to take questions now or do you want to?
I can take questions now.
Joe? Yes.
This shouldn't surprise you. I have a
quick
comment question.
I'm shocked.
I know you are.
Look, I understand what you've gone through in terms of recruiting an OCB administrator. Both this most recent time and the time previous when you hired an administrator that unfortunately didn't work out, I talked to colleagues around the country who I thought would be appropriate candidates for the position. And they made it very clear to me that one of the major reasons why they didn't consider it was the salary. I recognize, we all recognize, the situation we're dealing with here in California. But the reality is that I think something needs to be done to upgrade the salary for that position in order for you to find someone who really will do an outstanding job. And the question that I have, putting my old personnel hat on for a minute, has any effort been made to do a national salary survey? For those who don't know what I'm talking about, that means that you go to comparable facilities around the country, and there are some, and find out what the administrators for those positions are making. Because that's the only way, I think, that you're ever going to have ammunition to go to the state and say, look, this job, and I don't recall what the OCB administrator job pays, I think it's somewhere in the 70s, but that was a few years ago, so I may be way off base. But the only way you're ever going to convince the legislature and the bureaucrats who oversee such things that more money is needed for that position is by doing a salary survey, by having your ducks in a row and saying, this is what comparable positions around the country make, and this is what you have to pay in order to get someone decent to fill that job.
So would you like me to answer that, or was that just a comment?
No, I'd like you to answer.
Okay. So, I agree with you, Mitch, and there's a couple of other things that we need, a couple of other convincing acts that need to occur. One of them is that the individuals, the organizations that have comparable facilities are willing to share some of that information. Some are. The state ones don't have a problem because if you're in civil service, hey, it's all public, okay? There's not much that isn't public. But those that are not civil service, those that are not publicly funded, are not obligated to share.
Oh, you're right. And look, let's call it the way it is. The NFB centers aren't going to tell you what their administrators are making. But, right. Yeah, the other, the state-run facilities around the country, that's public information, and they really ought to be assisting you. If you ask for that information, they ought to be providing it.
Correct. And so we have done some of that already. There's a number of other things that have taken place, and for those of you who don't know, the OCB administrator position was a classification with a single position in the entire state of California. So that was a great thing when it was created because you had that specialty. Unfortunately, the way that salaries get negotiated, those types of positions are often left out of salary increases. So one of the acts that took place a few years ago was to use what is called the Staff Services Manager 2 as the classification while preserving all of the requirements of the OCB administrator that are established in statute. So we have done that. We have actually looked at can we change that classification to something other than the SSM 2, and of course, one of the challenges that comes with that is that then your candidate pool has to be able to meet those requirements also. And they're not just the requirements of the OCB administrator, the WNI code. It's the requirements of the classification. You know, a certain amount of years of experience, whether it's in management, budgeting, et cetera, et cetera. So those are all great points. Don't disagree at all with you, Mitch. And I think that the long term solution really requires that what you're describing. Any other questions on OCB before I move on to BEP? And I'll certainly take questions, you know, throughout as long as Nelly would like us to sit here. Okay. Okay, so moving over to BEP. Back in 2008, by the way, it happened to be Valentine's Day, February, whatever that was, that year, 14th of 2008, I was asked to leave my assignment and step into BEP to provide emergency acting managerial responsibilities because they had no program manager and, to speak of, no assistant program manager. And so I stepped into that role, and I'm happy to say today that for the first time since then, we have a complete management team in place. We have a program manager, and we've gone through a few versions, but we believe we have a very good team in place now, which is Robin Simmons, who is a manager in the Southern California, and then Bill Shira, who is our former training instructor, who's the manager in Northern California that's joined Deb Myers part of that team. One of the other things that's occurred with BEPs in this time frame is that the classifications that were used in the program have been aligned to provide a better candidate pool and a more appropriate staffing for the program. So the supervisor positions have become manager one positions. So the Robin and Bill's position become manager one. The business enterprise consultants have become associate government program analyst positions, for those of you that know anything about civil service. And there's a couple of tremendous benefits to that. Not only did we get a significant salary, because let me just share with you that when I first came to the state, my first position was a supervising business enterprise consultant. And I very quickly realized that I had 10 times the responsibility of an AGPA and made $500 a month less than they did. There's something not right about this picture. So quick like a bunny rabbit, I jumped over and became an analyst. And so this is something that's way overdue. So this will do a significant improvement in our ability to recruit as well as provide promotional opportunities for our staff, because when you're in those unique classifications, you have nowhere to go. When I was a supervisor, the only promotional path was the assistant administrator. There was only one in the entire state. And from that, it was administrator. That same thing, one in the entire state. So Deb Meyer has been able to accomplish that. And for those of you who are here that dabble in the civil service process, you know that is no easy feat. So great kudos to her. Since 2008, The fee collected, the fee paid by the vendors into the trust fund has gone from $1.2 million to over $1.6 million per year. That is huge. In the worst economic times, the downturn that we've all experienced, less locations, same number of vendors. So again, kudos to her. That improved tremendously the health of the program. In August of 2010, I believe it was, new regulations were published for the Business Enterprises Program. When I was in that program day-to-day, the total sum of pages for regulations was somewhere between 24 and 25. And when the new regulations were published, the attorney sent them to me, and I wrote back to her and said, there must be something wrong with this because there's 164 pages. You guys must have doubled them or something. She wrote back and she goes, oh, no, and you don't have all the attachments. So there's a significant amount of ink that was put to paper with those regulations. And there's any host of issues that we could spend a day and a half talking about with that, but hey. I mentioned strategic planning. So the same effort that I described for OCB is taking place with the respective stakeholder groups for the Business Enterprises Program. And then the other thing, the stimulus money also allowed us to develop 11 new facilities in this time frame for BEP. A couple of noteworthy numbers here. There's a report that is prepared annually that is sent to the Rehabilitation Services Administration on our various programs. For the Business Enterprises Program, it's called the RSA 15 report. 110 vendor years, about 135 facilities, average income, $55,000 a year. Median income, $32,000 a year. Median means out of 100 vendors, 50 are above that, 50 are below that. Ada had also wanted me to talk a little bit about trainee recruitment. And I think that the lifeline of that program is really going to be contingent upon getting some qualified, energetic trainees into the program. We have 7 in the current class, and unfortunately one of them was hit by a vehicle and is needing to drop out, and so they'll be back in the fall class. But we have 6 very bright individuals in the classroom. And if you stop and you think about it, you hear succession planning. And they talk about the state that a significant percentage of the workforce is in excess of 55 years. And I want to say it was something like 50 to 60% of the workforce could retire in 2 years. Well, for the vendor community, you guys think the average age of the vendors is in the 30s, 40s, 60s? Yeah, or higher. It's way higher. There's a lot of vendors who have been in the program a long time, and we're not getting enough trainees to keep up with the attrition. So Ed also asked me to speak a little bit about the successful vendor, the successful trainee. And this is an area of significant concern to me on a number of levels. First of all, it is very, very difficult business. It's a perishable business. What you buy and sell goes bad. So it can't sit on the shelf for more than a prescribed time frame. It's a cash business. You get a lot of green money hitting your hands. And it's a very time-sensitive business. If somebody shows up for bacon and eggs and they're not ready, they don't care. They don't care the reason, the rationale, the excuses, the whatever. The truck was late, the cook didn't show up. It doesn't matter. They go somewhere else. But yet, it's a facility, it's an opportunity. It changed my life. I literally went into that program with a couple of dimes, a pair of blue jeans, and a pair of boots. And it really gave me the foundation, gave me a tremendous opportunity for home, for family, and career. So what is the kind of individual that makes a good businessman? Well, if it was that simple, if you could just kind of put a label on them, it would be easy, but it's not that simple. It is somebody that is a self-starter. It is somebody that is not waiting to be told what to do because there's nobody to tell them what to do. You are self-employed. It is somebody that is creative, thoughtful, that has good judgment, that has the capacity to build relationships, that has the vision to see where they want to take their business and to do what's necessary to get there. They have the leadership skills to do the right hiring, developing of their staff, as well as all of the other myriads of functions that go with running your own business. But one of the things that's really concerning to me is when we put somebody through training, we put them on location, and they fail. Because not only is that very damaging to the reputation of the program and to the facility that we're providing the service in, more importantly, it's very damaging to the individual. We loathe somebody because most of the time when they fail, it's over debt. We load them with debt. We, not any of us individually, but just the sheer process. You know, you're owning your own business, you're buying, you're selling, you get into debt. Well, even though that they can resign the program and be somewhat relieved of some of that debt, they're not relieved of the debt that they carry into their private lives. And so that's a very, very damaging thing. And I think we got to find a way to deal in a different way with some of that. Part of that is that the system that we have today, you come into, you go through the training, you pass your licensing, your certification, you get licensed, you go out into a location, and it's one size fits all. So if I come in and I really don't have the aptitude to run a large-scale cafeteria, I might end up in a large-scale cafeteria by happenstance, and here you go, I'm buried. Or maybe I just don't have any mechanical inclinations and running vending machines is my cup of tea. So I think in addition to making sure that people are appropriately trained, we need to revisit. When a trainee comes out of class, we need a system that allows them to appropriately align with the facility that they're going to operate so that the skill set of the vendor, the requirements of the facilities are much better aligned than what they have been. And frankly, there's a lot of people that end up becoming vendors. They've never worked, let alone hire, develop, manage cash perishable business. I mean, that's a tough road for anybody. So it's one of my to-dos is to revisit that whole process, including all of our stakeholders and all of our community, to find a different way to do that. Some states provide what is called, for lack of a better term, it's more of a mentorship type of approach where I might come in as a trainee and I'm going to spend a couple of years in an apprenticeship type of position working for another vendor so that I can develop that skill. When I first came into the program, we had a cap on the volume of sales that a facility could have before I was allowed to apply. For a lot of good reasons, we did away with that cap. But, you know, frankly, in some cases, maybe it was a good thing. So I don't know what the answer is, but I am convinced that if we don't do something about it, the future of the program does get jeopardized. Let me stop my comments here about BEP and take any questions. I think Rich has a question.
Okay, here you go.
Who has a question? Hi, Joe. Good conversation. As you know, 6 years ago, you had under Candela the VEP Youth Employment Program. It's one way of mentoring youth and getting them, and younger people in general, getting them interested into BEP. Is that something DOR could revisit again with the community partners? I know the Valley Center for the Blind did it. Junior Blind did it, and Lighthouse did it to really collaborate to get young people interested in BEP by the summer work experience.
Yeah, I mean, of course, I think it's important to revisit anything. And Richard, I think you were involved in setting that up, if I recall, and I wasn't in with the program then. So I one of the things that I'm curious about when we have a program like that and it's not functioning, what happened? Because I'd like to revisit, but I also like to make sure that whatever was the adjustments that needed to be made could be made. So I'd love to hear more from you about how that was set up and what your thoughts were and are.
David and I are fighting over the mic. One thing is, if it's possible to put someone like myself in place, or who, when I left the department, we didn't really replace someone who could do transition statewide. Maybe someone who can dedicate, whether it's a rehab specialist or someone who's dedicated to that program and that oversight, because it really won't carry on by itself unless whoever's in charge works with the community vendors such as the agencies like the Lighthouse and Junior Blind and other agencies who want to make that summer thing work. And if nothing like that's in place, it probably will fall apart. So it's some type of investment from someone within DOR to make that work. And then if you and I want to talk offline, I'm here until Saturday, Joe. I can give you some more thoughts.
Cool. Thank you. Another question I thought I heard somebody else ask.
Yes. Joe, this is David Jackson. Richard was just kind of touching on that. I want to know, how are you cultivating young recipients of the program? How are you outreaching to them to make this program work? And I'm talking from high school and maybe early on into college. How do you make this program accessible for those people who are really interested in this program?
I think there's two pieces to your question. The first, well, let me talk about the internal piece and then the external piece. The internal piece is that to become a trainee for the Business Enterprises Program, you first become a VR consumer. So we have done a significant amount of outreach to all of our blind field services counselors, as well as the other counselors in the department, to continually educate them on the program and the opportunity that it can provide. And I think part of that is making sure that we have good screening because, you know, counselors spend a lot of energy working with consumers, and sometimes if it's not a good match, you know, I think the counselors that are sitting here will tell you that it could be frustrating. So I think we need to continue to look at that. How do we address what is systemic, and how do we better identify what is an individual isolated incident on a consumer-by-consumer basis, whether they're an appropriate match, whether we just need to test them a little further instead of doing maybe 1 month of skills training or skills testing, what we call pre-evaluation. Maybe it's extended to see that. I think that part of that also has to be on our vendor community side in terms of them participating a little more actively with the pre-evaluations and making sure those individuals have the skills as well as in the training. So the internal recruitment is something that we're very engaged in. Deb Meyer makes presentations to blind field services pretty frequently. I think she did one not too long ago. Nellie is saying yes. Then there's another part of that, which I think is a broader question than just BEP, and that is recruitment for students who are blind and visually impaired at all levels, high school, JCs, college, and some who are not affiliated with the educational system either. One of the benefits about BEP is that you don't need a college degree. You do need a certification. And you do need to be a citizen of the United States. You cannot be an alien. I was. And it didn't let me in until I became a citizen. But those are really the two qualifiers, is that you are a citizen of the United States and you are a VR consumer. So we need to do much more outreach to our community as a whole to identify the individuals that need VR services. And then presumably as we do that, you know, once they become consumers, one of those options then, of course, is self-employment and self-employment in the Business Enterprises Program. And believe me, there's not a lot of self-employment opportunities out there that give you the financial, and I mean a significant financial support on a year-by-year basis. A lot of self-employment opportunities is, you know, you get set up, you get a good handshake, and you're on your own. BEP, it's there continuously.
And I have one more question. So you have to sell the idea to the counselor. In the priority, in the scheme of things, in all the programs for Department of Rehabilitation are extremely important. But where does this rank in terms of priority for the counselor with somebody who's coming in who's visually impaired or blind?
I'm not sure that I understand your question.
Well, okay.
Where does what rank?
Well, in terms of getting the individual to say, yeah, I'd like to be a part of this program. I'd like to do this. I guess it goes back to the recruiting. I mean, how do you get somebody who wants to come in and do this? This particular program. How do you screen them? how do you sell the idea to the prospective individual?
Well, I mean, beyond getting them to become a consumer first, because that's the first stage. I think one of the things that, you know, once they're a consumer, you know, the counselor is going to be working with the individual to determine what kind of career they're seeking. And if they're seeking self-employment, if they're seeking business, and counselors are here, we've got two supervisors here, they certainly can chime in here. I'm believing that that is an option they present to them. But, you know, let me tell you, when you start talking about becoming self-employed, remember today, with the technology that you have today, there's a lot of options. You know, you're looking at one of them. Okay, I chose to leave a perishable business, cash business, become a civil servant. Now, I don't know that I work any less hours these days. And I certainly don't make as much money, I can tell you that. But there are other options. So, and if you have any specific suggestions about how to better reach those individuals and where they are, I'd love to hear them.
Okay. Thanks.
Question up front here. Trisha.
Let's look at it from the other side. As I travel around the country and visit our state affiliates, all I hear about, with a couple of exceptions, is that the number of facilities are decreasing. There are a couple of states, I think, that are working very hard to increase the number of vending facilities. Iowa is one that comes to mind, but most other places, the numbers are going down. A few months ago, and I don't recall if it was you or Deb Myers, but I found out that you were going to be placing a vending facility at LA International Airport, which I used to have some responsibility for, working for the city of Los Angeles. And I was really excited about that. Because it's a big airport, and because we haven't had a vendor in a city facility in Los Angeles ever. No, that's not true. We had one in the City Hall cafeteria about 15 years ago, and ultimately he left. So I'm interested in a status report. How is that pilot program at LAX working out? And are you looking at expanding to other facilities within the city of Los Angeles?
So usually if I'm intimately aware of a facility, it's for one of two reasons. There's a real problem, or there's just something really phenomenal that happened, and, you know, it's been brought to my attention. So happy to report to you, Mitch, LAX is not on my radar at all, which means things are going well. Now, in terms of expansion, the numbers that I shared with you were 110 vendors, 135 locations. So quick math, we got 25 more locations than we do vendors. You talk to vendors who've been around a while, and they'll tell you, we used to have 300 locations. And that's true. And I can show you the list that's been closed. And every single vendor that knows them will say, yeah, we should have closed that. We should have closed it earlier because it wasn't making an appropriate level of income. The other thing that we have started doing over the past number of years, even now, we have 110 vendors, 135 locations, but many of those locations are multiple site locations, where in the past they were locations that would stand alone. We now combine them together to increase the opportunity for the vendor to make a good living. So the issue is not as much expansion. It is, where are the people to operate them? The other issue that we face, and this is another significant issue that we face in this program, we have built facilities that vendors do not want to operate. And they are very high-level income facilities. We built a facility in Sacramento. It's called the East End Project. And a full bar, sports bar, you know, the kind where you have 20-something TVs and you go in and you literally, sports bar and restaurant. Significant amount of money went into that facility. We had the permanent vendor that started it. we have any number of attempts to. There was another vendor that's been in there now for some years who at the moment has Fort Irwin as his facility, and we're trying to get, he's trying to get out of the East End. We've conducted any number of selection committees with no takers. It's a high stress, high demand facility. That's a great concern to us. I'm not sure what the future of that facility will be, frankly. With the stimulus money, we built out two women's prisons in the Central Valley and no takers. Okay? That means we ended up combining them with another facility. We built out the Otay Mesa border station vending machine route. High potential. Vendor went in and said, no, not for me.
But Joe, let me suggest something to you. And I hear you. But let me respond two ways. One, your median income by your own statistics is $32,000 a year. That means there are an awful lot of vendors making $10,000, $12,000, $15,000 a year. And I know I've heard you say you're trying to phase those low-end facilities out or combine them with other facilities. So, you know, on the one hand, you've got perhaps opportunities to go and find higher-end facilities. But my second point, we're blind people. We don't all have sighted spouses, and we don't all have access to transportation to go to some of these facilities, you know, along I-5. I give all the credit in the world to the guys and gals who run the roadside rest. But the reality is that Fort Irwin is in the middle of nowhere. These two prisons are in the middle of nowhere. So what I'm suggesting to you is more outreach within urban areas, such as city and county facilities, and I know you have facilities at some of our L.A. county buildings, but you still have now but the one in an L.A. facility at LAX, and I submit to you that as a blind person, it's going to be a whole lot easier for me to get to a vending facility, a cafeteria in City Hall than a women's prison in Lodi. And I think you need to look at that as a potentially a contributing factor to the lack of responsiveness on the part of blind people to your positions.
I agree with you. I think that is I think that is one of the factors. And the other reality is that some of those places we're going to, the reason we go there is because of the high dollar, the high potential for money. But I don't disagree with what you're saying, Mitch. You know, as a blind person, it's a lot easier to get around in an urban area than a rural area, by far. And by the way, the middle of the valley is nowhere. Is not in nowhere. I grew up there. Okay.
Can you take a bus from Lodi to Stockton four times a day?
Yes.
Yeah. You're lucky. You're there lucky.
Okay.
Get my drift.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. Any other questions?
You're Trish.
Okay. Okay, so I have VR mod. So let me tell you a little bit about the VR mod. And when we say VR modernization, it really encompasses two aspects of this. So let me briefly describe those and tell you more specifically about the service delivery. The VR modernization really constituted a revamping of our service delivery, but it also constituted the changing of our case management software system, which has been done, has been rolled out, and that's otherwise known as the AWARE or the Electronic Record System, ERS. Specifically about the service delivery model. For those of you who don't know, the current model has been in existence for some 5 decades, okay? And there's not a lot these days other than Mitch and I that survive 5 decades without changing. Yeah, at least. So a number of factors have contributed to us needing to revisit our service delivery model. One of the things that we have been hearing for years is that the time that counselors need to spend doing paperwork, doing support clerical functions and not doing counseling functions. And the counselors and all of us recognize the need for the counselor, the professional, to be much more actively engaged with the community. The Rehab Act of 1992 required that the counselor be master's credentialed to perform the 5 non-delegable functions. And we have been in a very, very long plan with RSA to get to that point. So one of the things that we have been doing for a number of years is to provide all of our counselors who were not master's credentialed with the opportunity to go back and get their master's credentialing so that as we moved into that phase where all of those functions were performed by what we call qualified rehab professionals or QRPs, you know, individuals had every opportunity to be prepared to be able to perform those functions. The 5 non-delegable functions are determine eligibility, determines level, severity of disability, approves the plan, approves amendments, and approves the case closure. So the team concept is really changing a one-on-one relationship into a consumer-centric relationship. And the best analogy or the analogy that we have found that has been most effective in explaining this is, think of yourselves as patients when you go into the doctor's office. It's you, but you have the receptionist, you have the nurse, you have the doctor, you have the assistants, you have all those people that work around you to meet you, your individual needs while you're in that office or in the hospital, whatever the case may be. So not to analogize the medical setting with the rehab setting, I'm not doing that. Okay, so Mitch, hang on, don't. but really think about the service delivery model that we are piloting in that fashion. So the consumer hubs around, or the whole team hubs around the needs of the consumer. So who is the team? The team, by and large, is 6 QRPs, 2 service coordinators, 1 employment coordinator, 2 support clerical positions, which we call office technicians general, and 1 supervisor. What are the anticipated benefits of the team? The QRPs can perform the 5 non-delegable functions, improve the efficiencies around consumer services, increase the consumer's access to staff and to services. So God forbid that Nellie get an opportunity to go on vacation, but when she does, her consumer still needs services. Increase face time between the counselor and the consumer, and counselors not performing the clerical support functions or spending an inordinate amount of time doing the paperwork that is required these days. And hopefully increase the capacity for us to serve more consumers within the existing resources that we have. And I think all of us would agree that we're not putting enough blind and visually impaired people to work. So we have now concluded the data gathering phase, which concluded at the end of March. By the way, we started a pilot back in October. It was a 6-month pilot for data collection. And so we have finished that. We have been learning and gathering the best practices from each of those teams. And one of the things that I wanted to digress here is think, is there anybody here from Carol Gallego's district? No? Yes? No? Okay. I wanted to thank Carol and her team because for Blind Field Services, they were the pilot team. And Carol's team covers from somewhere south of San Francisco over to Berkeley, over to Fairfield, and up north. So she has a number of counties that her team covers. And so she was the Blind Field Services team that was piloting this VR service delivery. Pilot benefits. This is some of the stuff that we have learned from our pilot teams. And we had 16 pilot teams. Some were full teams, as I described, and some were half teams, literally half of the composition that I had described in each of the districts, each of the 14 districts. There was an increase in staff interaction. And we found that rather fascinating, that you're thinking, God, these people are all in the same offices. They're all doing the same work. Why would this cause an increase? But the whole team concept has really caused an increase in the interaction of staff. We've literally had staff saying, you know, I never used to interact with my colleagues, my peers, and this really gets me to do that, and there's a lot of pluses to it. More responsiveness to consumer. Increased shared responsibility. One of the things that we hear from the various teams is, all you who are counselors here, and I know that Therese is here, and Bennett, Tricia, Nellie, and I don't know if there's other counselors here. I'm sure there's a few others. You guys never have a difficult consumer, right? Of course not. So one of the things that we're learning is that the team concept really allows the individual counselor to have discussion with their colleagues about that individual consumer and identify different ways to approach it and even sometimes align the right personalities together to work. So that's been one of the sort of unanticipated but welcomed outcomes of that. Cases are more readily staffed. I mean, whether it's a difficult consumer, whether it's what's the appropriate IPE, whatever it may be, there's a lot more interaction along those lines. And as I've said indirectly, silos are replaced with cross-team functionality. And consumers are reporting increased satisfaction with the services. I mean, we have consumers saying that this is great that I have a whole team attending to my needs. And that truly is a benefit. For Blind Field Services, this adds three new individuals to each of the teams. It adds two OTGs and an employment coordinator to the team. It provides increased support to counselors, and it provides for increased responsiveness to the consumer. So that's the basic general overview of what the VR team is. We have a lot of lessons, a lot of documentation, a lot of information to filter through over the next few months, and then, you know, take it from there. So let me stop here, and is there time for questions? Okay.
Joe, it's Richard again. It sounds great, and you know, I left the OR before it was starting, but so two questions. On a practical level as a consumer, how is there one point of contact for the consumer, or does a consumer have to have six different phone numbers to get a hold of six different counselors? And then from the vendor's perspective, if a vendor has to deal with the DOR system to go over billing or reporting, do they have to talk to six different people, or is there one point of contact? And if that one point of contact's out, how do you default to the second or third person on the team?
Yeah, and there's probably a dozen other things that I could throw on top of that, particularly when you look at Blind Field Services in a distributed geography setting, because not all the counselors are even sitting in the same office, okay? I mean, I described Carol's team. Literally, she's got staff in, I don't know, seven or eight different offices. So first of all, in terms of a point of contact for the consumer, yeah, generally it's going to be the QRP, and that QRP, of course, then is supported by the service coordinator, the employment coordinator, and an OTG. And what the consumers get educated on is when they come in, so who is, you know, here's your contact list. In fact, Carol and I have even explored a central number that could be used for consumers so that they don't have to dial for bodies. You can call a number, and that number is always going to be on somebody's desk. So there's one of the things that we learned in the pilot. In terms of vendors, it's not any different. Vendors don't function on staff. They function on transactions. And, yes, it's staff that perform those transactions. But by and large, if you are providing a service specific to a consumer, you'll be working with that counselor and their team. So we have not encountered any challenges there for the interaction between the consumer, I'm sorry, the service provider and the staff team. So is Mitch next to present?
Are there any other questions? All right. Joe, thank you very much for addressing these very important concerns and updating us on all this information. Thank you very much. Okay, I would like to invite Kate Williams and Debbie Bacon from the Lighthouse to talk to us about employment services and their program. Come on up.
This is Debbie Bacon. Can you guys hear me okay? Okay. Okay, I have to eat this microphone, I see. Okay, on the way here on the BART train, Kate was telling, we were discussing how we were going to do this, and as we got into the hotel, she says, well, you get to go first, and I said, why? She just made that decision. So, okay. So, here we are. Okay. I have been working at the Lighthouse for the Blind since September of 2011. It has been an interesting experience, as it always is when you work for a service provider and a private service provider or a nonprofit. When I came into the job was laid out one way, and as we are now in April, the job is laid out differently now. And I always tell people my job is a chameleon. It's always changing. And that's often very true when you work for nonprofits. You really have to go in not expecting to be doing the same thing all the time, and you have to be willing to make adjustments and step back and jump forward and begin to really collaborate with other people, which is one of the reasons why I personally think the new VR mod model is going to work really, really well once some of the bugs get worked out, which there's always going to be bugs with new processes. But initially, I was charged to work with work adjustment training, which basically, at that time, described to me was people would be working out in the community with short periods of time and have individualized one-on-one attention with problems they may have while they were working. Let's say, for example, they come to work late, and it's a repeated problem, and that becomes an employment barrier. My job was to go in and help them figure out why that's not working so well. As we went along, we began to run into problems because different counselors were expecting different things from what work adjustment training might be. People on the staff at the Lighthouse had different perceptions of work adjustment training and what that might be. And so eventually we had a certification for rehabilitation services provisions at the Lighthouse where they come in and they do a 3-year evaluation and they look at everything that you do. They cross your T's and dot your I's and look at your files and look at how your programs run and what you're doing good and what you're doing not so good. And through that process, DOR came out with a whole new design for how they would like to see work adjustment training be provided, which all of a sudden meant my job completely flipped around. The way that I handle what I do flipped around. So what that now means is that if you have a counselor, I'm going to give an example because it's just easier to give an example. I have a counselor who actually works in Carol Gallegos' unit, and she calls me and she says, I have a person who thinks they might like to be a receptionist, but they really haven't had any experience. And I'd like to bring them in for a couple weeks and give them some on-the-job training, which they do get paid for. And I'm going to tell you what I think their problems are and their employment barriers are. And so maybe she'll say they appear not to have very good technology skills. Now, they've had training, they've had JAWS, but when they're actually working in that position, something's not right about that. Or maybe they need work on telephone skills. They're not exactly as polite as they can be on the phone. So they will come and they will sit down with me and we'll go through an interview process and I'll find out what their skills are, what their transferable skills are, and we'll negotiate with people on staff about where they might work and how often they might work. And then they spend time actually with someone who does that job with me supervising, and we work for 2 weeks for 5 hours a day, and they learn how they can do that job and how efficiently and more effectively they can do the job. And maybe that means they need to go back and retrain. After they're a week, I'll call the counselor and I'll go, you know, I know you said they had jobs, but they really are not applying JAWS within Microsoft Word, and that's part of what they need to know how to do as a receptionist. This is where the barrier is coming. I see now what's going on. But there's no way to know that until you get someone in that position and actually practice at doing the job. So in some ways, it parallels BEP because that's what BEP is supposed to be doing. It's supposed to be preparing people to work in a specific type of work environment with specific skills that they're prepared to do. And so that's one function of my job. Another function of my job is to do corporate outreach. We are really wanting to see more people get employed, and we're wanting to see them get employed in long-term, sustainable, and gainful employment where they're making money that they can pay their bills on, they're getting some kind of insurance, so they have medical insurance, and they're not having to live half in a job and half on Social Security benefits, which is a large percentage of people who are working who are blind. If they're working, live in that little halfway, half-in-out job. And that's no way to live your life and plan ahead and have any kind of security because those jobs tend to disappear quickly. So we are reaching out to companies. We just had a meeting this morning with Kaiser, and we're starting to stretch out with Kaiser and see where we might be able to go with them. I've met with Target. I have a possible opportunity at the Berkeley Bread Project that I'm looking at for a different counselor. And this is all not just from my point of view, but it's from counselors' point of views. And they come and they talk to me and they say, this is what we want to do. And I say, yeah, I want to do that too. We need to find a tool to make that work because right now it doesn't work. And even though it's what we all want, we don't have the right kind of tools. And so I talked to my executive director, Brian Bashan, and I said, this is what I want to see. This is really what I want at the end. This is my target. This is what I want, and this is what we have. This is the situation. How do we get from point A to point B? And I thought, you know, we need a longer-term work experience. We don't have that. DOR will provide support for transition summertime employment because that works with kids who are coming out of high school into the job world, and they can work with the Department of Ed, and it all kind of works together well for a very short period of time. And DOR will provide support for on-the-job training once you've already got a good job that you're going to be working in and you get good skills, and you go right in and someone comes to your job site and they help you work out the job. And you can have that job for about 90 days, and then you, if everything works well, you technically can be bumped off of services because everything's okay and that's what you're supposed to be doing. You're supposed to be getting a job and you're supposed to be moving on. You're not supposed to be staying in the DOR system for years and years and years. That's not what it's designed for. But there's this huge middle ground where there's nothing there. There's nothing there for middle-aged adults. There's nothing there for seniors who might want to go back to work. There's nothing there for someone who suddenly loses their vision at the age of 35 and needs to have a whole change up in the way they do their life and they do their employment. And maybe they could still do the job they have, but they don't know that, so they quit their job. And then they come to us 2 years later and want everything to be fixed and they want to go right into employment, and we have to tell them we can't do that. We just can't do it. There's not a tool in place. So I'm working along with Brian, and me being myself, I just sent a letter to Joe Xavier, and I said, Joe, I have these issues. I have these problems. I have this concern, and I've talked with counselors, and I've talked with supervisors, and we all know what we need. How do we make it work? What do we do to make it work? And it's an ongoing process. I'm looking at possible grant opportunities so that we can fund this somehow, maybe through piloting something and trying something out. This kind of program existed a long time ago in state DOR services, but because of budget cuts, it disappeared. So I want to build something, and one of the reasons why I'm here today is I want feedback from consumers and professionals about what they see as positive and negatives of this experience, and I want to start collating and collecting that data for my own knowledge and for grant supports purposes. I think it's really a vital thing we can do. My target for this would be a 3 to 6 month full employment placement while you're actually learning transferable skills that you already have and applying those, where you're improving upon your soft skills and where you're also improving and learning your blindness skills all at the same time. So that you have time to learn about a company, the employer gets to learn about you. It's not a quick in and quick out where the employer goes, well, I'd like to hire them, but you know, what about the safety issues and how much is that computer going to cost me? If you have more time to work with them, those things will eventually evolve out of the way and you can get down to the real work experience that that person needs. So that's another part of what I'm doing. And in that venue, I have been collaborating with Carol Gallegos, employment specialist or employment, what's the term, Joe? What are you guys using now for that? Thank you, employment coordinator. Her name is Lisa Morales, and her and I have been working together on reaching out to employers. We just attended the San Francisco Mayor's Committee for the Employment with Persons for the Employment of Persons with Disabilities had a job fair. That's a, you should see their acronym. And they had a job fair, and they had all these really cool employers there. And there were people from all sorts of areas, and Kate Williams, who's going to be up in just a minute, brought a whole bunch of people from her program who are current job seekers, and they got to go to all of these different employers in a much smaller venue than a normal job fair, and it was wonderful. And that's the kind of stuff that I want to encourage and I want to support. And because of that experience, I started talking with Kate and our supervisor at the Lighthouse and with our executive director, Brian Bashan. And we are in the process of discussing about how we might have a job fair at the Lighthouse that focuses specifically for our consumers and bringing companies from the Bay Area, because I think bringing them to us works really, really well. And so that's what I do. I'm going to hold off on questions because I want to let Kate talk, and then we can have more of a whole group kind of question session.
I'm a stander-upper. I talk when I'm standing up, so I hope that's okay. In fact, I'll probably walk around a little bit. This is not about me, but I feel compelled to tell you a little bit about me so that you can understand why I have such a passion and feel that I'm the luckiest person in the world to be working with the Lighthouse and particularly heading up the Employment Immersion Program. I'm one of those people that I don't know a lot about the blind community. I have to be really frank with you. I've been in the corporate world for many, many years. I've really been blessed with having a wonderful career in human resources, and then all of a sudden I lost my vision. So I'm one of those people that Debbie refers to that had a life and was functioning quite wonderfully in that life and then lost my vision to the degree that I could no longer do my job. So I'm one of those people that came to the Department of Rehabilitation and asked for help. I wanted to keep my job as an executive recruiter. It was my life. It was how I made a living for my family. And so losing my vision was sudden. It was a shock. And I didn't know what to do with my life. But the Department of Rehabilitation really did save my life. They sent someone to my office and showed me about adaptive technology and told me, you can keep this job because you can suddenly see your computer. Oh, gosh, what a wonderful gift that was to me. So it was at that time that I realized that, you know, there's a whole community I don't know about, the blind community. And quite frankly, for a number of years, I shunned it. I thought I was, you know, hotter, smarter. I didn't really engage in the blind community for a long time until the job market started to go to pot. And as an executive recruiter, I was having a little bit of difficulty making a salary. I mean, it hit the recruiting business extremely, especially at high-level positions. It really hit hard. So one of the person who taught me adaptive technology owned a company called Adaptive Technology Services. I'll forever be grateful to them because they gave me an opportunity to start working with people who were seeking employment. So my background in human resources And in placement of individuals as a recruiter led me into a position where, as I said, I feel I'm the luckiest person in the whole world because it blends what I know from the past and what I'm learning about the blind community. And one of the things that I'm learning is that regardless of what our stories are as blind or visually impaired people, those people who want to work, I firmly believe there's a job for everyone who wants to work. Blindness is not, it doesn't define us. It's part of who we are, and I still think there's a position for everyone who wants to work. So that's the guiding, I guess you call it the guiding light behind what we do at the Lighthouse. I'm so grateful to be working with someone like Debbie, who is working with people and getting them prepared for work, but there's that other segment of people that are already ready for work. And one of the things I like best about working with Debbie is that we're very conscious of, you know, people just don't stand in one place or another. Many times they're ready to work or they think they're ready to work, but maybe they need some adjustment. And sometimes Debbie's working with people who really think they need some adjustment, but they're ready to move forward. And that's one of the things that we're trying to blend at the Lighthouse is to present a program that fits every single consumer. If they want to work, we want to give them the tools that will allow them to come to work. So the Employment Immersion Program, as we set it forth, that we set into it last year, we had a great stimulus grant. Gosh, that was a wonderful time. We have money to spend. We were able to do some things that we didn't think we'd be able to do before. We had a summit that was held up at our Enchanted Hills camp. Some of you attended that. It was a marvelous experience. But on the more micro side, there were people who were attending our employment immersion classes. And we started out by thinking that we would present modules that would be 3 months long. It's a long time. We wanted to really immerse our people in the experience of hunting for a job. So the nuts and bolts were there, and we worked with people over a period of 3 months. We met twice a week, and we really did have quite a bit of success. Out of those first classes, we've employed 25%, well, almost 25, 22% of the people that have attended the program have found employment. That's pretty miraculous when you think of the job market as a whole. That just doesn't happen today. So we feel very, very proud of that. On the other hand, there's that core of people that just, you know, they're trying, they're working, they're not finding employment. Part of that is the job market today. Part of that is because maybe we weren't approaching all of that way we were trying to find help people find jobs. Maybe we weren't doing that quite correctly. So this year, we've realized the importance of having a group. It is so important. That synergy that develops between people who have a common goal is so important. It really is. And we didn't want to give up on that part of it. So we have 2 month module now. And for the first 4 weeks, people attend classes. And this is where they learn the nuts and bolts, the resume building, the cover letters, the importance of tailoring resumes to meet the needs of employers, the hidden job market. Everyone joins LinkedIn. It's the only way to go today. And we've actually, at our last class, we had a person from LinkedIn come in and speak with our group and work with them hands-on. So we teach them all the different techniques and all the changing techniques in today's job market. It's not as if it used to. Job boards no longer work, so we teach them how to look for a job. And then we teach them how to interview. We have videotaping. We have three-way observance. We have one student interview the other. They change roles. We have someone observing. They give one another input. We have professional human resources people that come in and observe people in their interviews and give them feedback. So when a person is out of that first four weeks, we feel they have all the tools that they need. And now what we've learned is that people really do need individual assistance. No two people have the same job goal. No two people have the same backgrounds. No two people have the same kinds of hurdles or barriers that are in front of them. So it's important for us to be able to work with them one-on-one. So for the following 4 weeks, we don't let more than 72 hours pass before we're working with that individual job seeker, and we are setting goals for them that are specifically designed for their needs. We're following up with them every single week. How are you doing? What are your barriers? What's getting in your way? And then at the end of that same week, we talk to them about their results. And then we start setting goals all over again, or we carry some goals forward. That way we're working with them for a solid 4 weeks, three times a week, on their specific goals. And we're finding that model works better. But we're always looking to our counselors. We're always looking to our consumers to get input as to how we can make this program better and how we can make it more successful. So I think that my message to any of you, if I don't know how many, are there any counselors in this group today? No counselors? One. We really want to talk to you about your consumers as to how we can serve them, how we can get jobs for people. That's why we are here. It's all about employment. Not everyone that has vision, low vision or blind wants to work, but for those people who want to work, we need to provide them with the ability and the tools to help them find that job. And so that's the reason I think I'm the luckiest person in the world. And if you have any questions for either Debbie or I, we'd be so happy to take them.
Does anybody have anything? Oh my gosh. Oh, you do?
No, I don't.
Oh, bitch, you do. Hi, this is Alice. You mentioned that you had some successes. So can you just give a couple of examples? What were those successes?
Oh, here you go. I'll give you the... Here you go. I'll give you that one.
Yes, I can give you several examples. And, all of these examples, oddly enough, are directly related with the amount of effort that each and every one of the consumers put into their job search. I think that's the exciting part of it. So we had a young lady, her name, I think David Jackson's here. And David was in the class where three of the people that found jobs, the first class that we had, three people from that class have found employment full-time. One is Shamika. And during our classes, quite frankly, Shamika buried herself. She was behind her computer. We didn't even know she was listening to anything. But she was. She's just a quiet, reserved young lady. She just graduated from college. She was the first person in her family to attend college, and she was very proud of that, quietly proud of that. And what she was doing during class was she was searching for jobs, and she did find her job on a job board. It was usajobs.gov. She found her job as a scientist. She's moved to South Carolina. She's working for the Department of the Navy, and her title is scientist, and she is making more money than I am. Pardon? Very happy, very happy outcome. I just talked to her, Tricia. I talked to her this week. She called just to say how she was doing, and she's doing marvelously well. Another person is Michael Peterson. Michael came all the way from Sacramento twice a week to attend that class for 3 months. You have to hand it to him. And he was given the chore of adding at least 30 people to his LinkedIn. And I think he was in competition with his wife, who was a Facebook fan and had 1,000 people on her Facebook. So he decided he was going to have 1,000 people on his LinkedIn. And he did it within a matter of 3 weeks. 1,000 people on his LinkedIn. It's not the way I work LinkedIn, but it's the way he wanted to do it. And he didn't restrict himself to just jobs that were, in his area. He just reached out, and he's now working as a counselor in the Department of Rehabilitation in the state of Pennsylvania, full-time in the general, not in blind field services, but in their general capacity. And he's making more money than I do. we had Chanel, Stewart, who ended up with a job at Travis Air Force Base. We have individuals who have gone to work for the city of San Francisco in the role of in human resources. If you want to know more. Yeah. But each and every one of them, it was a direct result of them having worked very hard in their job search and being determined and moving forward all the time.
Something that I just thought of when you and Debbie were describing this, one of the things that we probably should spend a little bit of time talking about is how educating you and Debbie on how to navigate the state's civil service recruitment and selection process. Because there's an awful lot of, and I'll be talking a little bit about this tomorrow during the general session, but there's a number of exams that are now online and open. And I'll tell you who gets state jobs. It's those that know how to navigate and those that are persistent. If you're waiting for the job to come to you, good luck. But if you're willing to get out there, there are jobs to be had.
Mitch, yeah.
I knew a trigger question.
Actually, it triggered slightly before. I wrote recently two columns as ACD president on employment and where I see employment trends going the next 5 to 10 years, having spent 20 years of my 34 with the city of LA in human resources. What sort of got that discussion going or got me to thinking about it was some discussion on our general membership list on employment and people who said, well, I wouldn't want to leave my city, my town, my community to get a job. And I took some issue with that because you need to go where the jobs are. And I'm curious, how much effort do you need to put in to convince folks that just because you've lived in a particular area the first 20, 25, 30 years of your life, that isn't necessarily where you're going to find a job? You know, I was really lucky. I was able to find a job in my area, but I was looking all over the country when I was back doing job search 100 years ago. But I'm wondering how much of an issue of that is that for you? You know, people have built up their support networks, they have families, maybe they've gotten married. How much of an issue is that in your job and maybe even Debbie's to convince folks that, hey, you may have to leave LA, you may have to leave San Francisco?
Is this one? This one does work. Oh, wow. Technology is wonderful. You know, that is a really hard thing. And people really get stuck in their little comfort zone. And it is complex. If you have a family, that means your spouse has to move too. You know, do you separate? Does one stay there? Does one go? What, you know, it gets very complex. If you have children in school and they've been in that same school for a long time, there's lots of emotional issues that back that. But what I always tell people is exactly what you and Joe both have said. That job isn't going to come to you. The first thing you need to do is make sure you can get there. And one of the other big problems we have is people will look at jobs where there's no transportation. And that's total unreality. And a lot of this, I think, I see comes from an adjustment. They're still adjusting to their vision loss, whether they've been that way their whole life or they just bumped into it 2 years before. I really believe it's another form of adjustment, and it's just taking them a long time to really get the full picture. I tell them my own story. I moved to Kentucky to look for work. I moved to England to look for work. I moved back to California and got work back home, but it was a very roundabout process. And I've moved from one city to another in California to look for work. And a lot of that, every time I do a job search, the first thing I do is look at transportation. Then I look at where the jobs are. Because honest to God, I need to know how you get around in that town before I start looking for work. I will not go look for a job if there is not a reasonable amount of options for transportation. So I don't have to, at this moment in time, deal too much directly with that particular question because I'm on the beginning of the process with my consumers. But I have experience. My background is actually in education. I'm in my very last class for my master's in rehabilitation counseling this very week. And so I'm really excited about that. It's been a long 3-year process, but I'll be done with that. So I have a wide background, and I have a lot of experience at looking for my own jobs, of dealing with people that are looking for jobs, and knowing that you can't wait for it. It's not going to come. And then when you look at the way you have to compete now for a job, it's so different than when I grew up, which is about the same time that I think Joe and Mitch grew up. You know, it's a different way. You can't walk into an office and say, oh, hi, I'm Debbie Bacon. Do you have an application? Can I fill it out? Where's the HR director? That does not happen anymore. It's online. If you can't use your technology, if you can't use JAWS, if you can't use Zoom Text, if you don't know how to use some kind of magnification, if you don't know how to get on an iPhone or an iPad, if you don't know how to use your cane to get from point A to point B in that building, you can just forget it because you're not going to get a job. You got to get that stuff down before you do that, and you have to understand how getting a job works these days. And one of the key components is being willing to move for that job. So I encourage people all the time, and maybe you start out slow and you say, what about if you just moved to the city next door? You use the same transportation system, but you just have to move a little bit, not a lot. Because sometimes they need that step up before they can make a huge move. And honest to God, I think the bottom line is it cost effective to move? Is it really going to be worth making that move for that money? When I was looking for jobs, I lost a job. I had a great job at a company in Berkeley, and we lost our grant, and I was very upset. And I started looking for jobs in San Francisco, in LA, in other states. I was looking in West Virginia. A lot of the jobs I could not take because the salaries were so low in the areas that I needed to be working in. And why did I need to work there? Because they had transportation. So there's so many things to consider why people won't do that. But I really try to have that dialogue with them about, don't get stuck in the box you're in. Look at what other options are available to you. And maybe the job you're looking for, maybe there's another way to do that job. Maybe that particular title of that job is a title, but maybe there's other things you can do where you do the same things, but you have a different title, and that might broaden your ability to find work in other areas. So that's my answer, and I'll pass it to Kate.
I'm with Debbie. When I lost my vision, I lived in Laguna Beach. Does anyone know where that is? You have to have a car if you live in Laguna Beach. I don't care what you say. You can't even go to the market without having a car. So I moved to San Francisco. Why? Because of the transportation. I also worked at a company in Irvine, which is why I lived in Laguna Beach. And it was a pharmaceutical company, and so most of the people that we recruited into our company lived on the East Coast. So I worked with people all of the time, overcoming the hurdle of leaving a community in Pill Hill in Pennsylvania to move to Irvine, California, where the cost of living was 3 times higher than they'd ever thought about looking at. So Debbie's right. There's a lot to consider if you're going to make a move. It's not just about making a physical move. It's about how financially feasible is that kind of a move. But as far as working with the people that are in the Employment Immersion Program and having them open up their opportunities, this is something we always, always discuss. When they're coming into a search, they start working on focusing on their job search. So they have all those parameters down. What is extremely essential to them? If it's a geographical need to be someplace, then they're going to contain their job search to a more local area. If they are more willing, then we really try to focus them to branch out. And it's always a point of discussion because there aren't, you know, we're actually in San Francisco, there is a pretty robust job market right now. It's on the rise as opposed to going down. It keeps going up as opposed to staying flat. In the East Bay, it's about the same thing. We see some more jobs that are taking place. So there are opportunities. We're in a good place. The Greater Bay Area is a good place to find employment right now. But as I said, Michael went all the way back east, and we have several people that are interviewing back east right now. So I think it's an important consideration and an option for everyone.
Nellie, can I just add a couple comments here? So you guys are presenting this. There's a couple of thoughts. As somebody who has hired a few people, first of all, in particularly consumers that are coming to you for services, I usually, when I talk to people about getting a job, and particularly with the state, my first advice to them is get in before you get picky. Because too many people want to start as the director of the Department of Rehabilitation. And good luck with that idea. But I'll tell you a quick story. I hired a young lady May 18th of 2000, and I want to say 2009. She started Monday morning at 8 o'clock. Welcome, glad to have you here. At 4:30, I said, I'd like to chat with you. You've done a great job. I just need to let you know we're going into layoffs. You have no control over that. You just need to show up, do your job. From the time we tell you, there's at least 30 days, and you're already a state employee. Just do your job and do it the very best you can. 4 months later, she doubled her salary. She went from an office technician to an AGPA and has done nothing but flourished since then. If you're picky at the outset, your door is very, very small. Get your foot in the door, then get picky. Number two is realize that your interview for the job did not start when the announcement went out. The interview for the job started the first day somebody laid eyes on you. How you walk down the hallway, what you look like, how you answer the phone, the tone of your email, when you showed up, when you went home, somebody is watching you. And you don't know when that person is going to be the one sitting across from you on the interview table. And that tie you put on and that clean shirt, if that's the first time somebody's seen it, it ain't going to help. Okay? And number three is there's one of the things that, and it's a complex thing to explain, but there's the J curve. A lot of times people want to go, instead of making an easy number, instead of making $10 an hour, they want to go make $20 an hour. I think that's great. But think about it from a J-curve perspective. You don't always get to go from 10 straight up to 20. Sometimes you got to go from 10 to 9 to 8 back up to 15, 20, 25, and 30. And so when you're looking at that, and I think people lose that. People, you know, individuals get this mindset, I'm going to start at the top because I'm worth it. Yeah, you may be. But so is the other 400 people that submit an application. So.
Thank you for saying that.
Some people know this, and I've certainly written about it, talked about it. My first job after getting a master's degree in political science from USC was in telephone sales for a year and a half. That's what I found through my employment office at USC. My second job was working as an administrative assistant. In English, that means secretary. At UCLA, as it turned out, our rival. And I worked there for 7 months until I took the civil service exam with the city of LA. My blood boils when someone says to me, I've got a master's degree, that job is beneath me. As I've heard people say to me before, and I say, you know, I came out of college I've always had a pretty good ego, but I needed money, and so my first job was selling over the phone. My second job was as a secretary. I don't want to hear you tell me that a job is beneath you.
Well said. One of the things that we spend a lot of time on in employment immersion class is not just the interviewing itself, but, you know, like it or not, when you're interviewing with people, you're generally interviewing with someone that has vision. And so we talk a lot about body language, we talk about looking at the voice, we talk about not, you know, quite frankly, rocking back and forth. We're talking about some pretty raw things here, but it is the truth. I mean, interview skills don't start just in the interview. They're when they pick up the phone and call you for a telephone screen, they're listening to everything. They're listening to the outgoing message on your mail. They're listening to how you are receiving the call and how prepared you are, how much you know about the company. So you're right. All these little tiny things, it's not about just applying on a job on online. They're going to call you in for an interview and you're going to get a job. It does not work that way. So we try to prepare them for all facets of the interview process, beginning from the time you send your resume in. Every little thing on your resume has to be perfect. You have to have eyes sometimes to make certain that that's so. You know, everyone doesn't have a resume. You don't put together a resume and think, okay, that's the end of it. I have a resume. Those resumes today have to be tailored to the needs of the employer and to the job. And a lot of people don't get that. It's not that they don't get it. They just don't know it yet. So you're right. It's a complex process. Getting a job is not easy. Getting a job is a job. And that's why we insist that everyone spend at least 20 hours of their week immersed in the job search process when they're in the program. David, was that hard for you? 20 hours a week? Can David hear me? Yes? So David participated in the program, so I'm going to pick on him a little bit. We kept you really going, didn't we? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm holding the mic if you want to give it to him, Trish.
So, does this work? Yeah. Okay. So as Kate was alluding to, it's 3 times a week and it's several months, and the process is a long one, and I would have to say it was grueling, and it was. I mean, it was because. 20 hours is sort of a nebulous kind of thing because it doesn't turn out to be just 20 hours. You wind up because you become so wrapped up in it that you spend an incredible amount of time. I know that I like my weekends because I was able to do more on the weekends as opposed to the weekdays. But I accomplished quite a bit, I think, and I think other people did too. And it's not necessarily to say that I got a job out of it. I'm still looking, but the program did succeed in getting people, and they got their jobs. So, but it's all about the work. It's what you do to get that position. It's what you do to get yourself ready. If you've never worked before, it's a great introduction. If you've worked before, it's a wonderful way to work on what things you need to do. So, 20 hours is, it turns out to be more than 20 hours. I mean, that's what they, you know, oh yeah, it's 20 hours. Well, it's not.
Anyone else?
Oh, there's someone else. Okay.
Hi, Debbie and Kim. This is Therese. Are you guys in your program speaking about the, you know, side effects of your Facebook page? I had a consumer who notified me, this person wants my password. And I always talk to my, you know, consumers about that. That one threw me. That one, like, whoa.
No. Yeah. Do employers look at your Facebook page? I'm certain that they do. I mean, it's not that maybe they all, do they Google you? I'm certain that they do. That's where technology is today. So, I mean, you do have to make sure that your Facebook page is appropriately presented. And you can keep people from going on your Facebook page. I mean, you can privatize that, so to speak. I understand that. Mm-hmm. I would say no. That's my personal opinion. I would say no. Debbie may have a different opinion.
I certainly reinforce that no. Just as I wouldn't tell them what size shoe I wore or anything else. It's my business. And you can block people on your Facebook. I monitor my Facebook closely because I have family members, and some of them are young and they have very interesting expressive language. So if I see that, I take them off for a while till they chill out. And the other thing is I catch young people that I know, especially in the blindness community, because you may not have full access to that page and you may not know what's actually there on the screen all the time. Technology isn't perfect. And I will see someone's cell phone number and I'll say, hey, get that off of there because you don't know who's looking at this. It is a public venue. Even though you have your list of friends, it is a public venue. That's why there are ads there, because they want you to buy things and do things you shouldn't do with your computer. So you have to be careful. And I know that Kate addresses that in her program, because we've had conversations about that before. Go ahead.
Okay. If you develop a LinkedIn page, you could say, I would like to direct you to my LinkedIn page. It's my professional networking tool. So if you have a LinkedIn, you can deflect them from your Facebook by just directing them to your LinkedIn. It's a professional tool.
I got the thing. You know, I would just ask, Therese, when you're asking that question, and Debbie and Kate, when you guys are answering it, take the information you just shared and put yourself in the employer's chair and think about what happens. No, I do not ask for passwords. I do not. But I will tell you, because I don't, and Mitch was just telling me, this is going to be adjudicated. This is becoming an issue. But frankly, think about when the employer asks that question, okay? If that individual is not prepared to answer that question in a sophisticated way, walk that forward and think of, walk that, yes, because the employer is listening. And now sometimes the employer could be doing it to test,
mm-hmm.
or the employer could be doing it because they actually want it and don't get it.
I would like to add to that. I think it's the same as asking if I went into an interview and they say, oh, are you married? You know, how do you answer that question? You have to think about how you answer the question. It's the same issue as how do you talk about your disability? You have to think about these things ahead of time before you go into the interview. And this whole Facebook, Twitter, blah, 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 this is just a whole other road we're going to have to travel and figure out how it works. Because it's not just us. It's everybody. Everybody's getting asked this question. This is going to be a common problem. Before we close, there was something I wanted to talk about because I was listening to Joe. I was taking notes. And I want to go back to the BEP thing. I know you mentioned that the facility in East Sacramento with the whole bar thing and all that, I remember hearing rumors about that. Is part of your changing and evolving process for BEP thinking of other ways to have facilities, not just snack bar stands, not just cafeterias, but other types of facilities that are more out there and more hip and more cool? I'm thinking like I went to the mall doing some job employer outreach the other day, and they have like this little Keiko cupcake company. And it's just a little tiny company, but it's in the mall, and they're spreading out, and there's ice cream places, and there's all these little places, coffee shops, bakeries, something that will provide a service where someone can come in, but it's not just food service in the sense that there's a cafeteria and there's a vending stand. Or is that on your radar?
It is, and there's a number of issues that, well, remember that what creates what BEP has is a statutory priority to be somewhere. And they get to be somewhere. It's either in a state or federal building. They get to be there without having to pay utility and rent. Now, in certain circumstances, not all of them, we get to be in counties and cities with the same privileges. But it's typically within government. When you start stepping away from that, especially in this environment, the don't have to pay rent and don't have to pay utility becomes
mm-hmm.
that's a whole different discussion, number one. So then if you go back to that basic concept of what creates BEP, what creates that opportunity, by and large, if you go into a federal building, you know, what are they willing to have in there as a service? So what the statute mandates, of course, is the food service. Now, I will tell you that we have true entrepreneurs in BEP. There are some people, I mean, they do some amazing things. And so are there some doing the kind of thing that you're talking about, but not necessarily at the mall? Maybe they're doing it from their facility where they're creating these cupcakes and they're doing weekend caterings and they're doing weddings and all these types of activities. Yes.
And that's good. And that's why I asked the question, because I'm aware of how it's structured. And part of my question was, is it feasible to do that under the structure you know, under the regulations that you have, where you have the placements, is it feasible to change it up a little bit so it's more attractive to the younger people coming into the system?
Assuming that the building is amenable to the service we're looking to do, and assuming that we have, you know, it's within the scope that we can operate because we are publicly funded, so we have all the requirements that go with that, mm-hmm. and assuming that we have a vendor that is interested in operating that, yes.
Okay. And then another thing I wanted to speak to, as you were talking about why you're not seeing people come into the system, I happened to meet a gentleman as I was doing some internship work at Tricia Lee's office, actually, when I was doing some of my master's work, and I had a consumer call me, and he used to do BEP, and he left his, whether this is true or not, I don't know, because I don't know the guy, and I wasn't there, but what he told me when I said, well, why aren't you doing any anymore, he said it was a financial problem because where the facility was located, there were other fast food facilities around. And when we're talking about placing people in urban areas, because that's where the transportation is, which is totally valid and which is what we really need to be doing in order to increase employment and training in that particular field, is that then you get into this whole thing. And I'm thinking of downtown Sacramento, Joe, where you have all the state buildings around and all of the commerce around. And I'm kind of curious about how real is this problem, and do you see this come up a lot?
It's very, very real, and one of the things that often gets overlooked, we have a statute that creates, but it is the performance that ensures its success and its future. And when you are operating a building, hi. When you're operating a food service in a building and in the next block are two other options, three other options, you have to do something to get me to come to your facility, open my wallet, and take out money because the statute does not mandate that, okay? So whoever the vendor is, had better be doing something that says, I want to go spend my money at Debbie's. Otherwise, I get a choice. You can mandate the facility, but you can't mandate that the customer spend.
Thank
down
you very,
here.
Very much. Thank you, Kate and Debbie and Joe, for this very stimulating discussion and this information. My hope is that there are more opportunities to develop employment projects throughout the state and that there can be growth in BEP as well as in individual employment because it is so very much needed by the persons who are blind and visually impaired. So thank you very much for being here.